sudden, the fog descends. You're driving on 476, you're going 65 miles an hour, and you look out and you can't even see the lines in front of your car. In fact, you look to your left, and you can't see the trees on the other side of the barrier. Look to your right, you can't see the trees on that side either. You don't even know if there is tree. There are trees on the other side of the barrier. There might be a cliff that just totally goes down to the middle of nowhere, as sometimes in 476 it does, right? Thank you. But you can't see. And what's worse is you don't know when the fog is going to lift. Is it ever going to lift? Or is this going to be my whole trip? And as any of you that have driven down 476 know, it could be a long time before you get to a rest stop. Could be a long time before there's an exit. And there really aren't too many U-turn places. You're stuck. You're stuck going down 476 in the fog and hoping that everything will turn out. You don't know if there is another car in front of you. You don't know if there's a big pile up in front of you that you're going to encounter. You just don't know. We encounter these things and we wonder, is there any way we can control this? But in the back of our minds, we know that there isn't. We can't do anything. When we encounter the fog, we know that we aren't in control of the weather. We can't say, be gone, and it's gone, right? We aren't Jesus. We're stuck. We might pray that it goes away, and maybe God will take it away. But a lot of times, we have to deal with the fog. We have to deal with the fact that we can't see what's ahead of us. In the same way, when we encounter the fog of life, we can't control what's going on. We can't control whether or not the fog lifts. Like we're going down 476, you hit the fog of life, and you're driving through, and you're like, well, I can't pull over. There's no shoulder. I can't turn around. There's no U-turn place. I can't see what's ahead of me. Am I going to crash? Am I going to die? You don't know. And in fact, what makes it worse than 476 is that you can't even slow down. When you encounter the fog of life, you encounter the fog of life. You have to figure out how to deal with it. So what do? The fog isn't lifting. So what do? First of all, I want to explain, what am I talking about when I'm talking about the fog of uncertainty? It says, my title of my message today is Fearing Rightly, Navigating Through the Fog of Uncertainty. What does it mean? What is the fog of uncertainty? What am I talking about? Well, for instance, take a look at American politics. It's coming up, right? It's coming up in a few months, a little longer. Look at our upcoming leaders. As far as I know, and from what I see on Facebook, everybody is completely divided. No one seems completely happy with anybody. But the problem is that's what we have. We're stuck with them, right? Maybe we could just toss it all away and start all over again, but good luck with that, right? So we're stuck. We're stuck with these people, and we're voting for people, and we're trying to choose the lesser of two evils, right? But what we know in the back of our minds, again, is that this leader, whoever it is, is going to be the one that represents America. In fact, it'll probably be the one that represents America for the next 4 years. It'll represent America to the rest of the world, and it will also come up with policies for us. And we all sit there and we're like, oh no, what do we do? Some of us who aren't happy with any of the leaders are like, oh no, it's going to be chaos, or everything's going to crash down, it's going to burn, America's going in the tank. What do you do? What do you do when you encounter these situations? Or to take another thing, for instance, look at the changing demographics of America. We are quickly becoming more and more multicultural, and we can't stop it. Not that that's a bad thing, but I'm just saying that's what's going on. If Pew Research predictions are correct, non-Hispanic white people will no longer be the majority in less than 50 years. Again, not saying that's wrong. But what I am saying is that it's changing. America is changing. But not only is America changing, Christianity is changing. Not only is America becoming more and more religiously diverse, I don't know if you saw that news article a little while ago. A Muslim mother went up to one of the principals at a school and said, hey, you know what? You celebrate Christmas, you get Christmas break. How about getting Ramadan off? And the school district was like, well, we don't want to cater for everybody's religion. We don't want people to have Ramadan off. We don't want them to have Hanukkah off. We don't want them to have every single religion's holiday off. So you know what? We're having summer break and winter break. And if that's where your holiday lands in, then great. If it doesn't, sorry. So already the religious atmosphere of America is changing. And again, we can't really control this. We look around and there are more and more atheists all the time, right? A lot of people, one of the most prevalent and growing religions in America is atheism, or no theism, where people, you ask people, well, do you believe in God? And they go, nah, and they're fine. Where once it used to be people, everybody, whether or not they actually acted like they believe in God, were saying, yes, of course, I believe in God. Pew Research also says that Pentecostal charismatic Christians make up 1/4 of the world's Christian population. 1/4. That's out of 2 billion Christians in the world. Eventually, the biggest Christian influence will not be coming from the Northern Hemisphere. You think of Christianity, you think of Europe, you think of America. No longer. Christianity is now going to Africa and to South America and to Asia. So Christianity may be becoming charismatic and Pentecostal, and the centers of Christianity is becoming the place of places like South America, Africa, China, and other parts. And what does this mean? It means that Christianity is changing. Right? We hear Donald Trump saying, we want to make America great again. Well, what America is it going to be? Because America has changed. Christianity has changed. And what do you do when things are changing? What happens when you get disoriented? To narrow the focus a little bit more, perhaps you are looking at your job security and or unemployment. Perhaps you are afraid of losing your job. Perhaps you have already lost your job. You're becoming or have become disoriented. You look at life in a different light now. Yeah, where once you said, I know where my livelihood comes. I know where that I have job security. I know that here's where I go, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I know that this will bring money for me. Now you look at it and you go, I don't know. I don't know where the money's going to come from. I don't know where my next job will be. Your life has changed. What do you do? Perhaps you are moving and you realize that you are leaving your friends, your family, and your culture behind. If anybody's moved from this place to another place, from another place to this place, you will know that there are different cultures, even within America. There are different cultures within the same state. And a lot of times you wonder, will I even fit in? Will I fit in this new culture that I'm going to? And the uncertainty, the fog of uncertainty descends. Maybe for you it's not any of these. Maybe it's failure or school decisions, relationship problems, a new disease or a new problem, or maybe even a death, where a death strikes your family and it seems like the fog of uncertainty has descended. So what do we do? What do we do? How do we face these challenges? We know that we can't turn around. We know we can't stop. We know we can't pull off the next exit. We know that we're here. We're stuck. And unless God lifts the fog, we're going through. So what do we do? Well, let's turn to Exodus 1. Exodus 1. If you have your Bibles, you can turn there. If not, I have the passages up on the screen. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his own household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The total number of people born to Jacob was 70. Jacob was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died. And all his brothers, and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, Let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies, and fight against us and escape the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, the other Puah, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill them. But if it is a girl, she shall live. But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and allowed the boys to live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every boy that is born to the Hebrews, you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live. First of all, I'm going to kind of move through Exodus like a story, so I'm just going to kind of go down. But first of all, what do we see? We see sort of a prologue, right? If we look at the first section, we see that the author is calling for us to remember the backstory. We've all seen shows and movies with recap sequences, right? I'm thinking of 24 specifically, right? Have you guys seen 24? If not, don't worry about it. Oh, maybe, okay. But it says, right, it says previously on 24. And then it does like this really quick recap of all the important things that happened before, right? Trying to catch you up. So what is their purpose? Well, their purpose is exactly that. It's to catch us up on the things we might have missed, or it's to jog our memories in case that we didn't really understand what the important features were. So we're looking at Exodus 1, and we're seeing the author saying, all right, I'm starting this next part of the story. Here's what you need to remember. And they have to cover the important stuff quickly. So they might leave out some stuff, or they might assume some stuff, but they're covering some things that are vital for the story. And what do we have? Well, if we look at Exodus 1 at the beginning, it says, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each of his household, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The total number of the people born to Jacob was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. So, what's the important stuff? Well, I've just kind of grabbed a few of the important things for you to look at. The sons of Israel came to Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and that whole generation. The Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Now let's take a look at these a little closer. The Hebrews are immigrants in Egypt. We know this, right? We're like, okay, thank you. We've seen this already in Genesis, right? Well, here they are. Joseph is dead and gone. Again, something that we've already seen, right? Why is the author bringing this back to this? And then we see that the Hebrews are procreating. Again, we knew that. We've seen that a few chapters before. So why is the author bringing our attention to this? Why say this stuff? Because the backstory is so important. The backstory is incredibly important. The backstory must be remembered. As Steve was saying, right, in adult Sunday school, and again, if you don't go to adult Sunday school, go. It's helpful. But what he was saying in adult Sunday school was we need to have a long view of history, right? We have to have a long view, something where even though we very commonly look at history in light of days, right? We look at our history and we're like, well, yesterday we did this. Last year we did this. But as Steve was talking about, God looks at it in millennia. So God has this whole thing planned out. He is looking at the end from the beginning. The backstory is incredibly important because the backstory makes sense of the present. And it not only makes sense of the present, but it also makes sense of the future. But there's also vital new information here, and that is the entire generation is gone. So we already knew that Joseph, probably his brothers, we knew his dad was dead. But now we know that the entire generation is gone. And what's implied by this is that the Pharaoh is also gone. Right? It says, "Then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power in Egypt. Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." The new king. It says that the new king, if you look at the next slide, back one. It's okay, be patient with the guy on the slides. It's a new format, and I'm messing with him back there. So, a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing. Do you see what's going on? Pharaoh has forgotten the backstory. He's living his life as though his life is the start of history. And he doesn't remember how he got there. It's like Pharaoh woke up one morning and said, "Joseph who? You know, who's Joseph? What are the dreams? I know that there's a famine going on, but we have enough food, so big deal, right?" He doesn't think about all the preparation Egypt did. He doesn't think about all the things Joseph warned him about and all the things that Joseph did for Egypt in order to prepare Egypt for the coming famine. He doesn't remember the backstory. All he knows is that he has come to power and he owns everything. If you look at the end of Genesis, even the Hebrews themselves sold themselves to Pharaoh because they didn't have anything and needed food. So Pharaoh comes into power, and what does he have? Everything. And he can't remember his history. But then Pharaoh faces the fog, right? As we saw, Pharaoh comes into contact. It's like he wakes up one morning, yawns, gets out, walks out onto the terrace, and looks out and says, "Who are all these people?" And he sees that the Israelites, and the word is actually swarming. They're swarming the land. They're all over the place. Who are these people? And then when he's thinking about it, I don't know, maybe he's going for a walk. Maybe he's counting. Who knows what he's doing. But he realizes, you know what? They've grown too big. Not only they've grown too big, but they're so strong. And if an enemy comes, well, Israel's going to join them. Right? I mean, it makes sense, right? They own everything. They own all of it. They own Israel's lives. So doesn't it make sense that Israel would join the enemies and fight against him? We read this passage and we often neglect to put ourselves within the place of Pharaoh, right? We always want to put ourselves at the hero, right? So we look at it and we read this ahead, and this is the prologue, and we get to Moses, and we're like, yeah, you know, I want to be him. But we look at Pharaoh, and we're like, oh, I don't have anything to do with him, right? So we don't think about that. We skip to the good part, right? But we don't think about putting ourselves within Pharaoh. We don't think, well, this is a human being, and we could possibly act the same way he does. And it's possible. I mean, doesn't his fear sound reasonable? I mean, don't we do the same thing? We look at a people group that's on the rise, and we're like, uh-oh, get the shields out. You know what? We don't know. We're like, oh no, everything's changing. We're losing ground. We don't know. We feel like everything is changing so much that we're trying to figure out what to do, and we fear. And do you notice that Pharaoh stops thinking this might happen, right? He doesn't say, okay, well, you know what? It's possible that Israel will rise up. It's possible. He says, in the event of war, they will rise up. For him, he has dealt with this fear and his doubt so much that the only conclusion he can come to is that the only thing that Israel will do is that they will rise up and they will defeat him. So, what's the byproduct? What's the byproduct of Pharaoh's fear? The next passage says, therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, that's the Israelites, the more the Israelites were oppressed, the more they multiplied and the more they spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. You feel it? They're dreading them because they're oppressing them and they're feeling that they're losing ground, and the more they oppress them, the more the Israelites grow. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks. They made their lives bitter with hard service. They were ruthless in all the tasks that were imposed on them or that they imposed on the Israelites. Again, you see a common theme there. So what is the byproduct of Pharaoh's fear? It's oppression. Pharaoh's fear leads to oppression. He is saying, I don't know what to do. I need to stop them. I will oppress them. But not only that, if we look at the next passage, it says, the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom's name was Shiphrah, and the other is Puah, right? I put the meanings of their names down. When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on their birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live. So the first byproduct of Pharaoh's fear is oppression. The second byproduct of Pharaoh's fear is murder. Oppression isn't working. We have to turn to something grave. But then, immediately, the passage shifts focus. And it's almost like Pharaoh takes a back seat. And the protagonist of the story enters. The midwives encounter the fog. Right? It said, the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on their footstool, on their birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live. But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said, why have you done this? And allowed the boys to live. The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. But midwives encounter the fog. A lot of times when we read a story, again, this is something we do, right? We look at the story and we know the future, right? We know all the way up to Jesus. We know past Jesus. So we look at the story and we don't really think of the severity of the situation, right? But think about it. The midwives, after speaking with Pharaoh, after Pharaoh commands them to kill all the baby boys, had to go home that night. They had to go home. Maybe they met together. I don't know what they did. I'm sure they prayed. They got together and they came to a decision. But it was a decision that might cost them their lives. It's a decision that might cost them everything. But what happens when the midwives encounter the fog? Well, first of all, they remember their backstory. Again, this is important. I'm stressing the backstory very much because the backstory and a long view of history is incredibly important for Christians, and it was incredibly important for the midwives. They remember where they came from and why they were there. They're there because they are a part of the blessing given to Abraham. God blessed Abraham, saying that his descendants would be as innumerable as the stars and as the sands of the seashore. Now, there aren't that many of them yet, but the midwives know that they are a part of this plan. In fact, they are a key part, right? Because they are actually in the process of delivering the babies. And it's hard for the descendants of Abraham to be as numerous as the stars of heaven or the sands of the seashore when you're putting them to death. They remember where they came from and why they were there. They remember the creation mandate to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And they remember the promise of multiplication given to Abraham. See, when you think of through all these things, you go, well, what other choice did they have? Right? What other choice did the midwives have? It was either they kill them and disobey God, or not kill them and risk losing their own life. But the midwives encounter the fog and they can't see the future. They don't know. They might die. They don't know. And the midwives, instead of fearing man, instead of fearing the possibility of losing their life, they fear God. And the byproduct of the midwives' fear is, we look at the next passage, so God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. The blessing of the midwives is that there's even more multiplication and procreation. They are becoming part of where they weren't actually part of the promise before of Abraham, right? Because they didn't have kids. Now they're actually being included. They're being included in the grand story of Abraham. They are actually giving birth to children that would make up this big nation. But do you see the byproduct of the midwives' fear? The byproduct is life, as opposed to the oppression, or as opposed to the murder of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's fear led him to murder. The midwives' fear led them to life. Sure, it may result in their own death, right? But ultimately, it resulted in life. And in fact, it resulted in the life of one special baby boy, Moses. Eventually, their fear led them to freedom, as opposed to oppression. Their fear of God allowed Moses to be born and to live. If they obeyed Pharaoh, Moses may have been floating down the bottom of the Nile instead of in a basket. He might have been dead. But the midwives feared God. I'm going to take a little bit of a change of scenery because we are coming up on Easter Sunday. I'm going to take a look at Jesus. Jesus encounters the fog. What does Jesus do? Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, James and John, and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to them, I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me. And going a little farther, he threw himself down on the ground and prayed, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want. Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, so could you not stay awake with me 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. For the spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again, Jesus went away for the second time and prayed, my Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. Again, we see Jesus is deeply grieved, even unto death. He's crying out that if it's possible, God, take this from me. It's hard to imagine that Jesus was not sincere in this plea. He didn't want to go down this road. But at the same time, he understood that he was not to fear men. He was to fear God. He is not to fear for his own well-being. He has to fear God. Jesus, he could have run away, right? I mean, he's God. He could have done anything. He could have blinded their eyes. He could have ran and hid. He could have, who knows? He could have called down thousands of angels to come and rescue him. But he feared God rather than he feared his own life. Jesus encounters the fog. As you can see, you imagine the fogginess of Gethsemane where he's sitting there and he's praying and weeping, and tears of blood are pooling down from his face. And you can imagine the uncertainty of what is this like? What is death like? What is separation from God like? What is being counted as sin for us like? He's dealing with all of this. And what does he do? Well, Jesus knows the backstory, as is evident from his whole life. He knows why he's there. He knows his purpose. He knows that he is the culmination of Israel's story, right? He knows that Israel's story was going somewhere. The scary thing, of course, is, where is it going? right? It's this big story of Israel, and Israel is supposed to be the light of the nations, and the nations are supposed to come and worship God in his temple, and their story is going somewhere, but where is it going? Jesus knows that he is the culmination of that story. He knows that the blessings of Abraham had to go to the entire world. And how were they going to go to the entire world? Through him. Through his death and through his resurrection. Jesus remembers the backstory. He knows why he's there. The backstory gives light on the present. He knows why he's being oppressed. He knows why he's going to be killed. He knows the future. The backstory informs him of all of this. I'm sure he might not have known exactly how everything would feel or how it would be to be separated from God and dead. But it helped him out. And when Jesus encounters the fog, he fears God more than he fears for his own life. He died for his enemies. He had every right to fear for his own life. But he feared God instead. And the byproduct of Jesus' fear, of course, is life and freedom. Life for all of those who call upon his name. Life for us, right? I mean, I don't know how many Israelites are in this building, but I'm guessing that the majority of us are Gentiles, right? Life. Life to the world. And freedom. Freedom from sin and death. So navigating through the fog of uncertainty, what must we do? Grace Fellowship, what must we do? Well, we must remember our backstory. We must remember where we came from. If you are living your life and you encounter fear and you go, I got this. Or if you're like, yeah, you know what, I haven't screwed up before, so I'm going to go for it. Or if you encounter the fog of life and you think you can handle this on your own with forgetting the rest of the past, forgetting what Jesus did, forgetting the story of Israel, forgetting what his purposes and his plans are for the world. If you go through and try to judge and discern and figure out and navigate through the fog of life like that, you're in danger. And others may be in danger as well. So we must remember the backstory. Where do we come from? Do you know the backstory? Are you reading? Are you reading the Bible? Another thing is, and this is not as important, but are you reading history? Do you know history? Do you know how Grace Fellowship came to be? Do you know what evangelicalism is? Do you know why you're here? Why you're in America? Another thing we have to do is we have to fear rightly. Again, the fear of Pharaoh clouded his mind, where he saw that the only possible thing that could possibly result from the multiplication and the procreation of Israel would be that they rose up and fought against him. It became like there was no other option. It had to be that way. And it's fear that sounds commonsensical, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound commonsensical? Doesn't it sound like, well, hey, I mean, yeah. Wouldn't you? Right? But it's a fear that leads to death and oppression of innocent people. The fear of the midwives and of Jesus is a different kind of fear. It's a fear that clears the mind. And what I mean is that it's not that you have an empty mind, right? But it's a fear that when you look at those situations of life, when you look at the fog and you can't see what's ahead, you look at it from a transcendent or a heavenly perspective. You look at it knowing that God is doing this in the past. He has done this in the past. He has done this through Jesus. He has worked out all throughout history his purposes. I think of I was listening to someone. It's close to what Steve was saying today in Sunday school. But I was listening to someone debate a secularist humanist on a podcast. And the secularist humanist came up and said, it was almost in frustration. He kind of gets kind of whiny, but it's in frustration. He comes up and he's like, oh, you know, David is just really upset because Christianity is losing ground in America. And I had no idea how David would respond to this. But David said, he's wrong. I have a longer view of history and a longer view of what God is doing in the world to be discouraged by the fact that Christianity might be in the decline in America. he understood that the purposes of God were far greater, and that what God was doing in the world will win. And he knew that he didn't have to fear that the Christianity is declining in America. What he had to do was fear God. He had to know where he came from. He had to know where he was going based on the long narrative of God. It's a fear that sounds absurd. Talk to anybody about it, right? Say that, oh yeah, I don't fear death. You know, kill me, right? There's, who was it? It was one of the pastor friends who lived in an endangered country. It was a friend of, what's his name? I can't remember. Oh, David Platt, right? He's a friend of David Platt. And they come up and say, we're going to kill you. He's like, oh, great. He's like, "That, you know how many more people will listen to my sermons because they know that you killed me? Like, everybody will. The world will be like, hey, this guy was put to death for what he believes. This is great. I want to hear what he has to say. And so the government was like, well, we better not put this guy to death. In fact, nobody put this guy to death because that's what he really wants. So, right? I mean, it's a fear that's contrary to nature, because you're like, well, of course you fear for your own well-being. You fear for your livelihood. But the midwives understood that the fear of God meant more than that. And it's a fear that leads to life and freedom. It might lead to our own death. It might lead to our own persecution. But it's something that leads to life and freedom. Do you remember why we're here? Do you remember our backstory? Are you fearing rightly? And finally, are you praying fervently? Again, the midwives, doesn't say that they were praying, but it doesn't say they weren't either. I have a feeling that they probably were, right? I have a feeling that's probably like Daniel, and Daniel, after the decree of the king, walks up and prays immediately. But even so, looking at our greater example, Jesus Christ, we know what he did before he encountered the fog, and while he was encountering the fog. He was praying fervently. Are we praying fervently? You wonder, what the heck is our country going through? What's going to happen? What is the end result? What happens if Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, what's going to happen to our country if these guys become placed in power? And you feel like you can't see the future. You don't know what's going to happen. Are you praying? Are you praying fervently like Jesus did? Maybe it's death. Maybe it's sickness. Maybe it's the loss of a job. Maybe it's fear that we, whatever group you're in, you're going to be the minority. Are you praying fervently about it? Are you praying fervently, or are you thinking, hey, you know, I got this. I'll use my own strength. I've done it before. Are you fearing rightly, and are you praying fervently? I'm going to close with prayer, and then I'll give our benediction. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the time that you have placed us in, dear God, a time where we can be people of prayer, people that fear rightly, people that can look back at the backstory and know what God has done in the past, and therefore have an idea and a hope of what God is doing in the future. Help us, O Lord, to keep our perspective right. Help us to not fall into the commonsensical fear that leads to the death and oppression of many people and to innocent people, dear God, but that we will have the fear that is of God that ultimately leads to life and freedom. Dear God, help us to remember our creation mandate and the Great Commission, that we are to multiply and to procreate through our witnessing, dear God, that we are to bring more and more people to be Christ followers. Help us, O Lord, that we will be wise people in the coming times, that we will be wise when we encounter Good Friday and Easter, that we will be wise when the elections come, we will be wise in any situation that's going on personally within our hearts and our lives. Dear God, help us to fear rightly. In your name we pray. Amen.